If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say welcome back, to the Independent Football Podcast. I am your host for today, Jack Pitbrook. I'm here in Seville. It's just gone midday, and I'm sat with Miguel Delaney, reflecting on the two England games we've seen this week. The 0-0 draw in Rijeka on Friday night, and of course the 3-2 win here in Seville yesterday evening. I think it was probably one of the best England wins that I've ever seen. It's already been talked of compared to the 5-1 in Munich in September 2001. So I think certainly probably a better performance than anything we saw at the World Cup or anything under Southgate so far. Miguel, what did you think?
Yes, but when as time passes and kind of the circumstances are put in the correct historical context, maybe some of that talk will fade away. It's very easy to get taken away in the immediate aftermath of the game. But in saying that, it can't be denied that this was just such an emphatically impressive performance. And I think you are right. I mean, regardless of what actually means in the wider term, I don't think of England. I've seen an England team play like that. I've actually never seen them play like that in person, a game I've been at. And I think that I haven't seen them that good, or that, I suppose, that assertive against a properly good side since Croatia 2009. And even that Croatia game felt as if that was a Croatia team. It was a classic case of Slaven Bilic, where he was losing his control of the team, and England had that one tactic that kept catching them out time and time again. Whereas this felt much more complete. And even, I think I wrote this in my piece, but there's like I suppose a healthy debate to be had for England over who of the many had actually the best night. Was it Southgate, his tactics once again paying off, the switch to formation paying off, and just everything, and the way everything came together? I mean, in the way this was almost the performance we didn't see at the World Cup. Was it Sterling scoring twice? Was it Kane having one of his best games for England and yet not scoring, showing he has other qualities? Was it Rashford who got his goal? Was it Eric Dier who, I suppose, so much has made that tackle? But yeah, there were so many positives to take from it, and I think you're right. I think that's the best performance I've seen England for some time.
What really impressed me is, and this is something you don't often see with England, is it didn't look like an international team playing.
Yeah.
It felt more like a club team playing, in the sense that you had a team which had quite a kind of complex game plan, but which was able to kind of execute that game plan perfectly in a way which you hardly ever see with England. I mean,
yeah.
We always expect with England that, we're always told, you can't expect them to play that well because it's international football, so you've got to rely on set pieces or whatever. Even though we have seen other countries like Spain and Germany play in a more kind of coherent style, whereas yesterday, the game, every part of the game plan worked. Like the switch back to 4-3, sorry about the sound quality, we're recording this on an iPhone in a terrace on top of our hotel in the middle of Seville, so there's lots of motorbikes and horses along outside. It won't be our usual high sound quality on this episode. Every element of the game plan worked. The switch back to 4-3-3 worked really well. Kane dropping deep with runners going beyond him, which has been, lots of people have been unsure about, that worked really well. Pickford's long kicking, playing it out from the back. Like every little piece of the Southgate jigsaw clicked perfectly together, and it produced a whole, like the whole performance was of a much higher level than anything we've ever seen.
Also, as regards that, I mean, even though the win wasn't as massive or as sensational as it could have been, as it did look like it might have been in the first half, I mean, there were moments in the first half that they could go 3-4-5, and England would have been good value for it. But in a different way, that also allowed them then to pass a very different type of test, because I think they were resilient against Spain in that way. But also, in relation to what you're saying there, what's particularly impressive about Southgate in general is he's basically just a problem solver. Everything, he's constantly finding solutions to the many problems that international football throws up, and that particularly the English national team have historically thrown up. But one of those, I suppose, is in terms of what you're saying about them being a club team, one of the great contrasts now between the international game and the club game, and why the international football is really behind, is because coaches just don't have the time with the teams or the squads to properly work on plans. Where it feels like Southgate has found another problem around that, because of this, it feels like a very, very structured long-term plan that he's put in that allows, that means every single international week is just a chance to kind of tweak it, to update it. There's that bedrock of work that he's implemented, and it's usually impressive.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think really stands out about the switch from 3-5-2 to 4-3-3 is that it's both exactly the right response to the problem, but it's not like he's massively changed tack. It's not like he hasn't changed his principles or anything. The principles stay the same, but the implementation changes, which is something which managers like, say, Pochettino or Guardiola always talk about when they change formations. They say, well, the identity remains the same. We're just going to change the players. And that's exactly what happened with the 4-3-3. And the 4-3-3 was completely vindicated. Like, Southgate went to the 4-3-3 because he said that England didn't need the comfort blanket of the three centre-backs anymore. They were concerned about the wing-backs getting pinned back and England effectively playing a 5-3-2 and not being able to get out. And they wanted to be able to cause the opposition more problems. Now, if England had stuck with the 3-5-2, the same thing would have happened yesterday. Yeah. They would have got pinned back. They would have had to choose one out to Rashford and Sterling instead of having both of them. And obviously, with Rashford and Sterling and Kane in the front three, they managed to rip through Spain three times and go 3-0 up in the first half. So I think we can go into details all day, but I think in that particular sense, this was such a vindication of that of that change in formation, but also a sign of Southgate's confidence that he could do something for a year and not say, no, this is the way we play, this is our identity, and be kind of defensive about the 3-5-2, but to say, well, this has served us quite well up to this point, but actually now we've got a different set of problems we need to solve, and I think we need to find a different solution. The ability to think imaginatively like that and not be dogmatic about something you've done in the past is really impressive, and I think that is the kind of grown-upness that people like about Southgate.
Well, this is the thing as well. I mean, given that England were by no means the finished article at the end of the World Cup, because it's such a young team, it was kind of really almost the start of a cycle, and there's almost the argument that the World Cup came too soon in that regard. But I mean, given all that, I think the vast majority of managers who would have been brave enough to take the step away from a system that had worked so well for them and so quickly. I think it's a usually progressive step. And I think that feeds into something wider about Southgate's career. I mean, I was one of these, but when he came into that job, he'd looked maybe progressive and forward-thinking with the under-21s, but it's still just the under-21s and all is said and done. There were still the perceptions of what he was like at Middlesbrough. We were discussing it with Rob Draper from the Mail on Sunday before the game, but there's still the perceptions of what he'd done at Middlesbrough, kind of predictable, bureaucratic manager. Whereas, I mean, his evolution with the team almost reflects his evolution as a manager. Because, I mean, he's basically someone that stepped away from what he was, is willing to look at everything around the game. I mean, we think I wrote in a piece today about how he's such an admirer of Guardiola, you know, so willing to take on ideas. And it's that in itself is rare for someone to step away from football in that way. Look at the whole game. And, I mean, to be honest, we're not getting back to the same old topics. But you often think, especially with this wider debate over managers like Jose Mourinho and, you know, whether they're stuck behind the times, how many coaches could actually do with that, stepping away from the game and just taking this period of reflection?
Not many managers or people in any walks of life like radically change their approach in their 40s, do they? It's like we're not used to people doing that much evolving at that age. And I think you're right. If you look at other top managers, they are generally fully formed by that point. They kind of form themselves in their 30s and 40s, whereas Southgate has obviously continue to develop and grow in a way which is interesting. I want to talk about some individuals. I mean, you can look at almost any individual from that game and talk about how good they were. The few ones that really stand out for me are, I think that was maybe Harry Kane's best game for England, even though he didn't score. Yeah. I mean, Miguel and I have been talking about this before, this idea that Kane's idea of himself as someone who likes to drop deep and play passes. Like,
I've heard that he thinks he's best as a 10.
But I've often been quite suspicious when England and Tottenham have tried that, because I think it's not really making the most of Kane. Whereas last night, I think, was the first time I've seen it work. Yeah. I've seen it work, because obviously Kane was involved in all three goals, but it was brilliant work coming deeper for the first two goals. And in a way which never really came off at the World Cup. Maybe that was because he had two runners alongside him rather than one. But I thought it was a big vindication for Kane, and also proof that he can... he can be useful even without scoring and shooting.
Mm. Yeah, completely. I mean, it's quite an ironic inversion of what we always hear about Kane. I mean, one of the slight criticisms among the overwhelming positives of him at Spurs, say, is that because the way he plays, the team obviously is built for how he scores. Whereas this almost switched it, where suddenly he becomes a kind of a central player in the team who makes things stick. Like, two of the moments last night were almost Bergkamp-esque, to be honest. Or, well, I suppose he's a big admirer of Sheringham. But
yeah, I was going to say, yeah, certainly Sheringham-like in the through ball to Sterling for the first goal. And then how deep he was for the move in the second goal. He picked up the ball, like, about a good sort of 5 to 10 yards inside England's half. Collected Pickford's kick, turned, then passed to Rashford. So he's doing work so far away from the Spanish goal, but clearly, England have found a way to make that work. So again, it's another issue to applaud Southgate. I mean, Sterling, you have to say, it's probably Sterling's best ever game for England, certainly his best goal for England. And it's the kind of goal that you see him score for Manchester City sometimes, like where he doesn't get anxious or nervous about it. He hits it early with not much back left. De Gea had no chance, and you know, De Gea is one of the best in the world in those situations. And then you could see that the confidence from Sterling scoring helped not only him to score his second, but also Rashford to score. Mm. Rashford missed too much easier chances against Croatia on Friday night, but then when he was through, I wonder whether the effect of Sterling scoring had a positive effect on Rashford as well. And all of a sudden, it was like everybody seemed to raise their level really.
Yeah.
In that first half.
Yeah, completely. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's almost difficult to pick out who the night was best for. And you could have an equally kind of fun debate, if you're an England fan, about what was the best moment, what was the best pass even. One of Pickford's, maybe the Ross Barkley ball. I mean, that felt like a real kind of one of those moments that we might look back at in a few months. This is Barkley kind of recovering his best level, a little bit of a juncture moment for him, that expression that we've expected from him or wanted from him for so long that we haven't really seen. And Southgate, of course, made sure to put some of that down to the benefit of what the context of Chelsea right now. Another one, actually, maybe who won't get as many headlines, but Joe Gomez. I mean, looked more Sergio Ramos than Sergio Ramos at times, and I mean that in a positive way.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, remember also that England did this without a lot of the senior players from the World Cup. Like, I'd say Henderson and Stones, who are arguably England's, I don't know, let's say second and third best players. They were both suspended, but Dier did well in Henderson's place. And Gomez, like Miguel said, I thought he looked very strong, calm on the ball, very quick across the ground. They did it with Trippier instead of Walker. They had no Ali and Lingard. So that's basically the whole Henderson, Ali and Lingard, the whole World Cup midfield, which obviously was criticised in some quarters, but was the players that got them through to the semi-final. They weren't there, and Southgate managed to I actually think that you could make a case that Dier, Winks and Barkley is maybe a better balance of three midfielders than Henderson, Ali and Lingard. I think Winks was...
They didn't bypass midfield in the way you'd expect in some of these games. They played true midfield much more and did it against Spain. And Spain were really slack in the first half, but I thought Thiago was still excellent. So despite that, I mean, for England to have that success in the middle is very promising.
Yeah, and you can look at the way they... Winks and Barkley and Dier were all really good in their pressing as well with Spain, particularly after the first sort of 5 or 10 minutes when England were kind of camped in their own box a bit. They did manage to get much more aggressive. I mean, everyone will obviously talk about Dier flattening Sergio Ramos, which was a great moment for English people.
There's the whole argument now that is a bit of a Vinnie Jones and McMahon 88, Roy Keane and Mark Overmars 2001. Do we buy that?
I don't know. There's no getting past the fact that English people like this kind of thing. you can see the reaction from the fans, the reaction on social media, from other journalists. I know lots of journalists have written about it this morning, and I don't mean that critically. People just buy into this kind of stuff. Yeah. They like seeing a good English player flattening the big, nasty Spaniard, rattling the Spaniards. Yeah. And they were rattled. But
The one thing about it, I did know, I mean, I remember I was at Lansdowne Road in 2001 when Keane did it to Overmars, and that Ireland won 1-0 that day, and that was immediately seen as kind of tone setting. It was immediately talked about afterwards with some of the players mentioning it, and I think Keane himself as well. But in the aftermath, among the players, and I don't think Southgate was even really touched on it. I think he kind of brushed it aside a bit. And it wasn't much of a discussion.
Well, Eric Dyer was asked about it in the mix zone afterwards, but those quotes are embargoed until 10:30 tonight. So go on independent.co.uk at 10:30 exactly to read Dyer's thoughts on the tackle. Another one it reminded me of was... Oh, God, I've just forgotten it. What was the tackle I'm thinking of?
It was a cool football.
It was... Oh, yeah. I remember a good friend of mine who supports Everton told me that, like, one of the best moments... There was once when Manchester United were playing at Goodison in about 2006-07, and Phil Neville flattened Ronaldo.
Right, yeah.
And this kind of turned the game and their season around.
And they
went on to have this amazing season or this really good run. And genuinely, all the Everton fans said it dated from Phil Neville tackling Ronaldo, because that kind of got Goodison Park up, and then they went on to win the game and they won the next few. And I was wondering whether the same might be true of the Dyer tackle. Yeah. Like, this is the kind of hinge moment for the England national team, and maybe for English history. Maybe after years and years of decline, everything getting worse as a country and as a football team, this was the turning point. And from now, we're going to be heading into the sunlit uplands off the back of that Dyer tackle. And in 20 years' time, people will say, well, you know, the 2010s were pretty shit in the UK, but the 2020s were amazing. and it all started on the 14th of October 2018 in Seville.
The appropriate sound of horse hooves going by as we talked about industrial tackles. But I suppose it did... The one thing about it as well, it maybe just changes the psychological momentum of games like that. I mean, one thing that is difficult to escape was that Spain were, which is quite bizarre actually with Spain. The first 10 minutes they were excellent. Then there was a turn, they conceded the goal. But then they were appalling. Now, although I do think actually that they were frightened of what England could do to them in the break. I think and Luis Enrique maybe went into this a little bit in his own post-match press conference. But they did then adjust to what England were doing and began to regain control. But I mean, that's maybe more important than anything, that the fact that no matter how Spain were playing, no matter how slack or complacent they were, all the rest of it, that England, for about 20 minutes of that game, had one of the best sides in the world properly rattled and properly kind of, you know, tentative about everything they were doing.
Yeah, and that's why, for me, it stands out beyond the anything we saw at the World. I mean, I know some people have said, oh, well, the World Cup is more important. Of course the World Cup is more important. Yeah. Everyone knows that. But in terms of performance level, it's incomparable to anything for the World Cup, really. And you would have to go back. Certainly all the way to the Sven era. There's been nothing in the post Sven era. Mm. So that's under what McLaren, Capello, Hodgson, or Big Sam would come close to that.
And even the Sven era kind of died a death. I mean, I remember especially 2006. The 2006 World Cup was so drab. Yeah. Maybe the most stirring England game since England-Portugal. As you know, they went out, but the level of performance was at least, you know...
Yeah, I was thinking, well, England played really well against France for almost all of that group game in 2004. Yeah. They were brilliant for 85 minutes. And obviously that was a really good France team with lots of great players. Mm. So I'd say that's probably the closest thing I could compare it to. And England lost that game.
Yeah.
And I nearly cried afterwards.
Not me.
Certainly ranking wise it's very high. I mean, even the Germany 2001 game, I mean, we've all seen that plenty of times now, but that was really seen as a nadir for that Germany side. And I know Spain are just coming off the back of a nadir for them at the World Cup this year, after a really bad World Cup in 2014 as well, and a really bad Euros in 2016. So maybe you, I mean, we'll talk about this more after the break, but maybe you can compare this Spain team to Germany 2001.
In a different way. I mean, this is one of the frustrating things about praising aspects of our job. Selkirk goes into this specific matter in his own embargo quotes, but I think this...
Don't break the embargo. Okay. More on this after the break.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Was, as well as a vindication for Southgate, Miguel, was last night a vindication for the UEFA Nations League?
Yes, I think it was. I mean, basically, had that been a friendly, first of all, it wouldn't have gone the way it did, and it wouldn't have meant as much. But also, the entire match would have been diluted by subs. I don't think, like, had it been a friendly, I don't think we'd have seen that, the way Spain went at it in the last 20 minutes. So, I mean, there's been a lot of, actually, just to go back to kind of what it meant for England, I've actually seen a bit of a sniping, oh, it's just a glorified friendly, but Spain don't see it like that. Spain really want to win this competition. They really want to get the automatic route. So for a start, that's what England were up against. But also, okay, there was a few drab games at the weekend. There was Scotland's game. There was England-Croatia, which also wasn't great. And this happened in the World Cup as well. Then there's suddenly this rush. Well, this is rubbish. You know, this is boring. And then, like, you know, look, in the last two nights, we've had Germany getting trounced by Holland in what feels like a properly important match. And then this, which is one of the best international games I've seen outside a tournament for some time. So yeah, I think it is working overall. It's, if you look at it right up and down, you've got this at the top, you've got properly historic fixtures like Germany, Netherlands, then you've got what it means to all these smaller countries like Moldova, Armenia, you know,
Republic of Ireland.
The Republic of Ireland. Well, there's not much meaning in it there, not anything at that moment. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anyone calling that a glorified friendly is just talking bollocks. That wasn't a friendly. Like, we've all been to enough England friendlies. You know what they're like. Like, it's oleing. You know, the only action will come in the first sort of 60 minutes. By the end, it's just sub after sub after sub. England finishing with, like, David Nugent and Jermaine Beckford up front. This wasn't that at all. This is completely different. And even the Croatia game, like, I hammered the Croatia game in the piece that I wrote because there weren't any fans, which meant that it wasn't really football. Mm. But the football itself, it did improve as it went on, certainly in the second half. The fact is, England only made one change to put on Sancho, which is, you know, an attacking change to win the game. That didn't feel like a friendly either. Mm. And actually, you know, you could tell that England were keeping going to try and get that winner right until the end. And actually, if I'm now starting to think that if England had taken one of those chances in the Rijeka game, or if Danny Welbeck's equaliser against Spain at Wembley had been allowed, as it maybe it could have been, then England would now be in a much better position in the group. Whereas, because those England couldn't get over the line in either of those two circumstances, their position now in League A Group 4 is still not completely secure. Like, England could still fail to qualify,
yeah,
if they're beaten by Croatia at home and Croatia gets something from Spain. Which would be a disaster because it means we'd be relegated into League B for the next iteration of the Nations League. But I do think England have got a chance of going of winning the group. But for that, like, the crunch game really is Croatia against Spain in Zagreb,
yeah,
which is, I think, it's like the 15th of November, which I think is around when England are hosting the USA. If that's a draw or Croatia gets something, then England will just need to beat Croatia at Wembley a few days later to go through. And that means that we'll all be in Portugal in June, yeah, for the Nations League.
That'd be lovely, lovely. Lisbon, yeah. Although also, if Spain beat Croatia, then it's all over.
Yeah, if Spain beat Croatia, then they'll be on 9 points.
Yeah.
And the highest England can get is 7.
Yeah.
But I mean, let's get into Spain now, because Spain will have to play a lot better than that, won't, yeah, they, to win in Croatia?
Yeah, in saying that, they were atrocious for 35 minutes of the first half. I thought they were really good in spells of the second, though. And I was talking to a few kind of Spanish journalists afterwards. Kind of, they felt they're not too concerned about the performance, just because ultimately they think the fundamentals of the team are right. And it was maybe a little bit of a wake-up call. Maybe this is something, a bit of a danger with Spain, because I think we, even though there are obviously many more problems at the World Cup, we did see it seep into the game. It's almost like the superiority of the 2008-2012 period still permeates through this team, in the sense that as soon as they get any sort of get to any sort of high level, they just start thinking as if, well, our passing alone will be enough, without actually stepping it up in the way that really makes them, because that came across in the first half.
Yeah, they were so defensively lazy. Like, the way that they the way they allowed England to get in behind, the way that they allowed, like, just things like winning second balls, it was
They stopped pressing. One of the biggest differences with Luis Enrique's game so far has actually been the return of the Spanish 2010 pressing, whereas we didn't see that in the first half here.
Yeah, they were kind of all over the place. It shouldn't have been that easy for England to cut through them. It looked to me more like a mental failing than like a technical failing. Yeah. Like, it's not like they're not good enough. It's that for whatever reason, the players were not on it. They were caught off guard, and then they kept making the same mistakes.
Yeah, completely. And it was also another classic case as well of England found that one pro. Although I think there was much more to it than this, but they found that a lot like the Croatia game I mentioned earlier. But England found that Spain were particularly susceptible to one area, and they kept kind of getting in behind. I know there was a period in the first half where, like, it looked like England would score by every attack, because every single ball in behind was causing Spain real trouble, with that augmented by, you know, Marcus Alonso's response being to put up his hand for two of the goals, just standing there. Like, I think the third goal, as brilliant as it was from England, was particularly odd from Spain's perspective, just players watching Barkley, Kane and Sterling just play through.
Yeah, I think Spain also looked like they weren't really familiar with being pressed, like whether it's the dire tackle on Ramos, or there's another one where, like, De Gea hit, I think this is kind of towards the end of the first half. De Gea hit like a weak kick out, and I think it went to maybe Thiago or Saul. And Winks just charged forward, nicked the ball from him, and then England had a kind of 3-on-3, and it didn't quite work out. They lost the ball somehow, or the attack broke down. But you could tell that Spain's reaction was like, "Oh shit! Like, what's happening here?" And they just looked really unprepared for the power and the intensity of England.
Yeah,
what's the Spanish reaction been?
That's pretty much it. A wake-up call more than anything. Also, I saw a few of the front pages today. They're making an awful lot of the Jordan Pickford penalty call. And I suppose, and Luis Enrique actually said this himself. He said, had they made it 3-2 earlier in the game, he thinks they definitely would have come back. And I think that was the flow of the game. And I suppose you could bring it down to that Pickford incident. I thought it was a penalty, I have to say. I mean, there's the photo of Pickford with his hand around. And Spain did. They hit the bar after that. I think it was Alcacer. Then had missed another chance 3 yards out after Pickford parried. But actually, Pickford's an interesting one, because in some ways this is one of his best games for England, but also one of his worst. I mean,
With this kind of player, it's like, do you take, like, Alisson at Liverpool or to a lesser extent Edison? Do you take the risk? And I think good team like City and Liverpool take the risk. Like, it's worth having. If Pickford set up two goals by hitting, like, well, one kind of 50-yard pass to Kane and one kind of 80-yard pass to Kane, like, that is worth that. And also, like, the ability to build up from the back with kind of short passing. Yeah. That is worth the potential downside of screwing up one Cruyff turn. Like, you can't separate the two, but you'd rather have both of them than neither.
But the one thing I always get more so even with, previously I told Pickford, I thought he was almost immune to kind of stupid errors. Whereas this game, actually, because he fumbled badly for the corner for Spain's opening goal. And then there was a parry that maybe should have saw Spain make it 3-2 very quickly afterwards. So he had a few ropier moments that I've come to expect from him with England. He did make one brilliant long-range save as well.
Yeah, and he made that good save going down to his right, like, after only about 5 minutes. Yeah. When it looked like England were really on the ropes. Although, one thing that people say about Pickford who know him is that he's not someone who puts too much thought into what he does. And that means that if something does go wrong, it's not exactly going to be weighing on his mind.
Yeah. Unlike Joe Hart, really. Because Joe Hart is, from what people that know him say, basically, he really dwells on things like that, which a lot of goalkeepers do, which is why they go on these kind of bad runs then.
Yeah, England have had a lot of, like, introspective goalkeepers, like Hart, Rob Green obviously suffered a lot after that, the mistake against the USA. Scott Carson was never the same after the mistake against Croatia at Wembley. Ben Foster is someone who's spoken about his kind of struggles with the mental side of the biggest games. David James obviously had well-publicised problems in the 90s and 2000s. So it is like a long-running issue in English goalkeeping. That's why maybe someone like Pickford he's got that kind of, like, brashness that we need in there.
Yeah.
Another thing I want to talk about is the atmosphere last night. I mean, I'd never been to the stadium before. I loved it. And I thought the enthusiasm of the fans, not just today, sorry, not just for the game, but for the Spain's open training two days ago, where they were I know it felt like about 10,000 school children there to go and see it, screaming when the bus came in. That felt to me like a real vindication of Spain's policy of taking the team all the way around the country.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it really... It felt like such just a family-friendly occasion that way. And you really... I mean, for all the talk of what the Nations League mean and, you know, the life in international football, it was very much alive in Seville this weekend. Then, of course, you had that family atmosphere in contrast to some of what was going on around Seville, around the game.
Yeah, I thought this had been another shameful weekend for England fans. I don't know how much play it's going to get at home because there was nothing big happened. But certainly, like, being... I mean, I remember this is well-publicised, recent England games in Amsterdam and Dortmund. When you're in the city, you're obviously much more aware of just, like, the kind of, like, low-level unpleasantness of England fans. It's not like pitch battles. It's not like France 98 or Euro 2000. It's just lots of England fans who come over here and just behaving really badly. Mm. You know, littering, swearing. Offences range from littering, swearing, vandalism, low-level violence. Like, just the rudeness of being a guest in a foreign city and taking it over as if it's your own.
And then it becomes almost a little bit of a political act in that way. And in terms of, they occupy a space, and then you can just sense the aggression if anyone wants to kind of infringe that space or ask for a back. I remember a similar incident ahead of England-Wales Euro 2016 when I was working for ESPN, and I was beside Chris Jones, the writer there, and we were all far to the left, so right beside the fans. I remember these two middle-aged England fans, they put up a flag which basically covered the view of about a third of the pitch for journalists. And obviously one journalist went up and complained to an international journalist, and immediately then it just became like they had no concept of the fact that this what they were doing might inconvenience someone. It was suddenly it was again a political act, and that their, you know, space they'd occupied was being someone wanted it back or wanted it for the better good, and they just couldn't see around it. And I remember thinking of the game itself, and Chris Rushy talking, had England not basically won that game with a late goal to make everyone forget about that sort of thing, we might have been a bit here, because they kept looking over then towards the game at the journalists who complained. That's a very specific incident, but I think it actually reflects, you see that sort of thing so much when you're kind of in the general vicinity of the kind of this travelling band of England fans, a certain strand. But I think it's quite a sizable minority of England fans.
Yeah, it's very easy to say that, oh, it's only a tiny minority and the rest of England fans are well behaved. Like, it's visibly, put it like this, I imagine it's in the fans who come here with this attitude is definitely in like double figures of percentage of the England fans. It's not like two or three bad apples spoiling it for everyone else at all. And it's bollocks if anybody says that it is. But yeah, I think Miguel's absolutely right about that attitude. The attitude is basically like, I'm going to come over here and I'm going to make this my own. I'm going to make your space my own and treat it as if it's my kind of conquered territory.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put up my flags and sing our songs and have 10 pints. And if anybody looks at me funny or suggests that I shouldn't do this or suggests that this is not the right way to behave in a foreign city, then I will treat that as the most grotesque provocation.
Yeah.
And I will use that as an excuse to kind of raise the stakes, whether that's throwing stuff or just offering people out for a fight or bad language or whatever. And it's like they want to be challenged. They want to be called up on it because that gives them the excuse to react. And it's such a kind of English mentality. Like, it's funny. This is an issue where I do think that football fans in England get a hard time for all sorts of reasons. But there is a separate problem, which is the behaviour of fans of the England football team abroad. Yeah. And I used to think this was like something that like the sort of snobs would look down their noses at England fans, and it was bullshit to compare it to rugby fans or whatever. And I don't think that at all. I think that this is such a serious problem that it has to be... I mean, I don't even know if we can fix it, but if we can't fix it, we have to describe it.
I remember like there was a bit of discussion about this within the FA about 18 months ago, and one of the concerns was basically you have thousands of basically kind of mid-20s, early to mid-20s fans. And a lot of them are even, from what I've seen from police reports when people have been arrested, they're in respectable jobs, but the word was that when they go away with England, they basically use it as kind of, you know, these extreme stag parties. And there's not, you can't really stop that.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the FA are completely powerless. Like, how are you going to... Because you can stop people from getting tickets, but lots of people will travel, you know, will travel, get tickets from a mate, even not buy tickets, buy tickets in the home end. The point is not getting the tickets. It's flying here on EasyJet for 100 quid and then just drinking a lot. And the FA is completely powerless to like, stop the travel plans of young men in the... young men from England.
And there's a dynamic here as well, in the sense that, I mean, we go away all the time with kind of the English clubs in Europe. And, I mean, obviously, so much as what's happening now is put in the wider context of what happened 30 years ago with English teams and clubs. But the big... Okay, no one's naive enough to say there's never any incidents, but you don't see what you do with England with the big six clubs when they go away to Europe. And it does feel as if they now see themselves as kind of beyond that sort of thing, this sort of nonsense. They know how to generally behave better when abroad. And, I mean, this maybe ties into something we were discussing before the game. Most of the flags, you see, we went by one bar yesterday where we saw the Football Lads Alliance flag, which, you know, we all know the kind of the political... undercurrents there, what exactly they are, and around the Football Lads Alliance flag, the flags of some of the clubs, Hereford, Kettering,
Hereford, Kettering, Whitby, Tamworth, Leicester, Derby, Coventry, Blackpool. The only good team that you see is Chelsea.
The only big club is
Leicester, I guess. But generally speaking, it's very much flags from outside the Premier League, outside London, Manchester and Liverpool, particularly in the Midlands. And, you know, it's not unfair to associate that support base with a kind with a more kind of right-wing Brexit.
Well, I think I sent some of the flags to with the names of clubs to a friend, and he went looking through the referendum results from those areas, and a lot of them were quite heavily Leave.
Yeah, completely. And also, I mean, this is another point that I made on Twitter, which I'm going to put in a piece later on. Like, there is a growing, or maybe, I don't know, I think it is growing, a growing, like, right-wing nationalistic element to England. Like, it doesn't look like, you know, like Golden Dawn or National Front or anything like that, but, or... like Charlottesville, but like Football Lads Alliance is anti-Muslim.
Yeah.
Singing Fuck the Pope is like anti-Irish and anti-Catholic in a really insane way for people. Like we saw lots of people singing Fuck the Pope and on the way to the game yesterday, and these aren't even guys who were around in the 80s and 90s and when like the Troubles were like a live issue in British national life. Not that it would be okay if they were, but at least you would understand the context. Whereas here, these were lads singing it who would have been born after the Good Friday Agreement. Yeah, yeah. Like, why on earth would they choose to define their support of the English national team around saying, oh, well, we really hate the Irish?
But there was that lad, when we walked to the game because, I mean, it was bad weather and it was so difficult to get taxis around like that. But we ended up walking behind a group of lads, and one of them, who was at the forefront of singing Fuck the Pope, and also shouting things like, hey, taxio, he must have been about 18.
Yeah, it's so like as someone who's like an English football fan and a fan of the England team and a supporter of English football fans as a group of people, it's so dispiriting to see how awfully they behave and how little progress has been made on in an area where we tell ourselves that we're better than the rest of Europe, but we're not.
And there's a wider tapestry as well, because even when you made the point there about the fan, a certain strand of the fan seeing it as any sort of response to what they're doing as the most grotesque provocation, it basically reminded me, you know, a lot of the approach of the right to the Brexit negotiations, in which if Europe has any response back, well, you know, look at them demanding their way, we have to put a stop to this now.
Yeah, and that's why it's such nonsense when people say, oh, they're, you can't call them fans, they're not fans, they don't represent us. Of course they do. They're as English as anyone. Yeah. They're insular, arrogant, territorial. They don't see things. They're like complete lack of empathy. Like obsessed with themselves and this kind of English mythos. Like they are so obviously English. We can't. Anyone who says that they're not fans, they don't represent us, is ignoring the problem out of laziness. And I mean, they are more English than anyone, which is why it's going to be so difficult to solve, because they come from somewhere deep inside us.
At one point as well, to finish up on a maybe slightly humorous element to it, but two of the most heavily populated pubs that with English fans, where they were singing stuff about the Scotland national team, although one of the better chants during the last game last night was to Spain, "Are you Scotland in disguise?" There were more unsavoury chants about some Scottish players, highlighting the innate absurdity of a lot of this.
Thanks very much for listening. Next time, we'll give you a podcast recorded in our studio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.